If you're a maintenance supervisor at a manufacturing facility and your machinery isn't working right, Grainger knows you need to understand what's wrong as soon as possible. So when a conveyor motor falters, Grainger offers diagnostic tools like calibration kits and multimeters to help you identify and fix the problem. With Grainger, you can be confident you have everything you need to keep your facility running smoothly. Call 1-800-GRAINGER, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
Granddad Business with Aaron Caliber.
That's my dad.
Hello! Underpants?
That is hilarious!
Shut your mouth, dude. Rate and review this podcast while my daddy will go into a deep depression. Going down business with Aaron Cliver. Yeah.
Boom. Welcome to Grown Dad Business. This is Aaron Cliber. Today, we're going to do part two with my friend Harlan Williams. And before we do that, before I really get into that, check out my sponsor, goodsandevil.com. Awesome, cool nerd and movie shirts. Also, some shirts for vegans. And if you're into that kind of thing, I always say that if you're into that kind of thing, I think it's cool. Follow your heart. I like meat, but my friend Dan at goodsandevil.com is an amazing designer and some of my favorite horror shirts of all time. Check out goodsandevil.com. And if you want to see me live, I have a one-night-only tour. I talked a lot about it on episode, the first part of with Harlan Williams, so I don't know why you would start at part two. But if you have started at part two, go back to part one, the last episode, and listen to part one with Harlan Williams, where we talk about some funny things. But part two with Harlan Williams, check out harlanwilliams.com. You could see him on tour. I work with him a lot. We have a lot of fun, but we have some more fun on part two. We really just, we do a little bird calling. It's one of our passions, a little bit of bird calling. But really, part two is about Harlan's story of him getting into stand-up and getting into acting, and it's really fascinating and really an honor and privilege to have Harlan on, because Harlan just does not do a lot of podcasts, and he's my friend, and I appreciate him. Truly one of the kindest people I've ever met in entertainment. So enjoy my friend Harlan Williams.
Well, it started at a very young age. I knew I was going to be in the entertainment industry. I just had like this divine message. Like it was wired in me already. I knew, and I didn't know how, but I knew I was going to be in the entertainment industry. I remember I used to skip high school, like grade 9 and 10.
Oh, for sure.
Yeah. And I'd go downtown by myself. I'd go like, 1 o'clock in the afternoon, and I'd go watch movies, and there'd be no one in the theater. There'd be like 12 people. And I was a bit mystified, because I'd be watching movies and I'd be sitting there alone, and I kind of confused. I'd go, in my head, I'd go, I'm going to be up there one day.
Huh.
I'm going to be on that screen. And I didn't know why or how I was thinking that, but I just, I knew. And sure enough, it all just happened. So that's what I mean. It was just kind of in me when I was born, I guess.
So when did you start stand-up? When did you get on stage?
Once I got out of college. I did it about probably a year after I got out of college.
Yeah. But you were still goofy in college. You just never really did like a thing, like not sketch or improv or stand-up.
No, I didn't do anything, and I'd never done stand-up.
You're just a funny dude.
I was just a funny guy, and I knew I wanted to be in the entertainment industry, and I thought, what can I do with my life that's funny? I could travel the world. I could make lots of money. I could probably meet beautiful girls. I can go from stand-up, and it can segue into acting and voice work and whatever. And I just thought, well, my knack is making people laugh. So I thought stand-up comedy was that. Do you hear that bird?
That bird is amazing. Look at that. It's like a little.
I'm going to call him back. Hang on. Oh, now you don't want to talk to me.
He thinks he found a mate.
Oh, what if he comes down and flocks me?
What if he comes down and gets you pregnant?
Ooh.
You might have kids after all.
I might lay an egg tonight. Imagine that. He comes down and flocks me real hard, and I go lay an egg. This always scares him away. Ah! Because crows, all birds are beautiful, but then you get crows who sound like they need a tracheotomy or something.
Yeah, they sound disgusting.
Yeah. It's a beautiful little bird. I think it's a finch. Yeah.
Is it?
I think so. I can't see its head. I can see its torso.
You may be right. Man, it's going wild up
Let
there.
Let me try this. That shot him up.
Don't
okay.
Like that.
He stopped.
Don't like that.
He stopped right there. throw my credit card at him like a ninja star. Oh, now there's two. Wait a minute. Yeah, they are finches.
Oh.
Those are finches right there.
Now they're ready to meet somebody.
Jeez, I did the shh, and now there's another one. He called in for backup.
I think we got to give him privacy.
He's beautiful. It's red. It's like a red crested finch. I don't know what the technical name is, but I'm going to call that guy Big Red.
I like it.
Yeah.
Yes,
I'm here.
So birds.
Yes.
No, so when did you get on stage for the first time?
First time was, I think it was the early 80s, like 80, I want to say between 82 and 84, somewhere in there.
Do you remember how that happened?
Oh, yeah, man. It was in Toronto, and it was before the big comedy boom.
Sure.
It was the 80s, and it was, Canada had two comedy clubs in it, one in Toronto and one in British Columbia on the West Coast in Vancouver.
That's it.
That was it. Like, I got in. When I decided to make the jump into stand-up comedy, in my head I was like, this is going to be the most unique, weird career choice. Like, when people ask me what I do and I say stand-up, they're going to be, like, mystified. Because at this time, you know, there was like 20 comedians. There was Rodney Dangerfield, Don Rickles, George Carlin. Like,
yeah.
You know, it wasn't a common thing. Like,
right.
I thought, this would be a very peculiar career. And the first 2 years I was in it, it kind of was. And then all of a sudden, boom, it blew up. And suddenly everyone in the world, you'd talk to them, you know, you'd go get a coffee and, hey, what are you doing? Oh, I'm going to be a comic.
Oh, yeah, you're right. By 85, 86.
Everyone was doing it.
Eddie Murphy, a lot of other comics.
Yeah.
Roseanne, really just, and then there was comedy clubs everywhere.
There was comedy clubs. They blew up everywhere.
Right.
It was crazy. But when I did my first night, this will date me a lot, but it was back in the day when Holmes had one phone hanging in the kitchen, and it was a rotary phone.
Sure.
And we had to dial the one club in Toronto on Monday morning at 11 o'clock, and the first 15 people that got through got to do 5 minutes on amateur night. And in those days, there was no redial button.
Wild.
So I would call. It would be me, 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 me. You know, the busy signal, which a lot of your listeners won't even know what that is, which is scary.
No, we got some grown-ups.
Okay. And then I would have to hang up and redial all 11 numbers all over again. Me, me, me. And I, you know, my finger would be almost bleeding by the time. And I never got through for like the first 6 weeks.
Really?
And then I think the seventh week, all of a sudden, hello, yuck yucks. And my blood froze. Like, I was just like, I was petrified. I almost couldn't talk. And I'm like, yes, I'd like to do your amateur night. Okay, what's your name? Okay, be here at 8 o'clock. Yep, thanks, bye. And I got through.
Yeah.
And I was petrified.
That was your first time.
That was my first time, and I was terrified. So I go down, and, you know, they just kind of randomly put a list together.
Yeah.
And they put me on first, right after the MC, who was a seasoned pro.
Sure.
And, of course, I got selected to go on first, which I didn't want to do because I wanted to kind of see someone else warm up the room. And
right.
I wanted to see what other guys were doing. And so it was terrifying.
But you never even got a chance to go see, like, stand-up comedy, like, at the club.
I did. I actually had seen it. I actually went down to New York. I went down to New York for a little visit, and I went into the Improv in New York.
Yeah.
And I saw all these people. I saw Colin Quinn and a bunch of people that I didn't really know anything about stand-up,
right.
But I remembered them because it was my first time.
Right.
And then I went down and I think I watched two shows at this Yuck Yucks Club in Toronto.
Yeah.
Just to see what I was getting into.
Right.
It might have only been one, but I just thought I better go see how it works.
Yeah.
And that was it. I didn't do any research. I just, like I said, I was like, I think I know what funny is. I think I know how to write and tell jokes. I think I know how to perform, because to me, stand-up is more than just telling jokes. It's also a performance.
Right.
And so I walked out terrified, and I did it.
And how was your first set?
It was actually really good.
Yeah.
I was really scared, but at the same time, I was also kind of in ecstasy.
Sure.
It reminds me of a time I was swimming in Australia once on the Great Barrier Reef, and I went out snorkeling with this boat, and they said, look, don't swim too far away from the boat because there's sharks.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, I ignored that, and I went way off into the reef. And I was kind of looking in the water, and, you know, the water kind of fades. It goes from turquoise, and then the light fades, and it goes to black.
Yeah, yeah.
And all of a sudden, out of the blackness, this big, like, 9-foot shark just meandered. It almost like it was like a movie fading.
Yeah.
And it just was coming right at me, probably about 12, 15 feet below me. And I just froze. I froze on the water, and I went, oh, my God, I'm terrified. But I was also at the exact moment going, oh, my God, this is so exciting. It's a shark.
Yeah.
It could kill me, but yet I'm here with a shark. Like, who doesn't love a shark? And that's what going out on stage was like to me. It was like,
sure.
It was terrifying, but so exhilarating in the same moment. And that's kind of the thrill that I love about stand-up.
I do, too. I mean, doing years of improv and sketch, and when once I did stand-up, I'm like, oh, this is just me.
Yeah.
This is terrifying and exhilarating.
Yeah.
Right?
It is. That's exactly what it is. Yeah.
So you started doing stand-up. Was it a pretty easy, was it a good transition for you? Yuck Yuck start hiring you? When did you start actually, like, working?
It went great. I mean, the first show was good. The second show was not as good. And I went, uh-oh. But then I said, no, I got to keep doing this.
Right.
And then the third show was good. The fourth show was, you know. So most of them were good. And within about 4 months, the club was saying, you know what, you don't have to call in anymore on Mondays. You're just in. Like,
nice.
Start coming down every Monday night. And then they had, like, kind of a promotion thing. Like, if you did good on the amateur night, you got promoted to what they called regular nights.
Yeah.
And you went from doing 5 minutes to 15.
Nice.
And so I was the second guy out of our group to be promoted. And then within 2 years, I was headlining.
It's great.
I was ahead, but I was very aggressive because I knew what I wanted.
Sure.
And I literally went into the guy who ran the whole thing, a guy named Mark Breslin, great guy. He was the king of comedy in Canada. He ran the show. And I was very bold, and I said, Mark, can I come in for a meeting? And he goes, sure. And I remember sitting down in his office. I said, Mark, I love you for giving me a stage, a microphone, an audience. And I said, from here on in, Mark, I just want a headline.
Yeah.
I said, I don't want to open anymore. I don't want a middle. I said, I don't want to sound cocky, but I'm doing better than the guys I'm opening for. And I said, from this day forward, I'm just going to headline or I'm not going up. And he just looked. When I looked back, I didn't even realize I was being cocky. I was just following my spirit.
Right. Yeah.
But I remember him looking at me, and he was just silent for a minute, and he just went, "Okay." And that was it. From that moment on, I was
every comedian hearing that right now is going, "Bullshit!"
No, that's for real. That's 100%.
No, we believe you, but it's like, you know, you're
well,
like.
Well, I just knew I was convicted. I had a conviction, and even when I started in Toronto, I said to myself, this will be great to get started in Toronto.
Yeah.
But remember what I told you about going to the movie theaters?
Sure.
I said, this is just to get me started.
Right.
I was already picturing myself in front of the Grauman's Chinese Theater in Hollywood.
Right.
It was preordained for me. That, and in a way, it was great because I never worried. I was never insecure. I never had to worry about being not confident because in my head, it was predestined. I knew.
Yeah.
I told my friends in college at animation school, I said to them, this is before I'd even decided about stand-up.
Right.
I said, guys, I don't know why. I don't know how. I said, I'm going to be on David Letterman one day. And they were like, what are you talking about? I said, I don't know. I said, I know I'm going to be on David Letterman. They go, what? And I said, and when I do it, I'm going to put peanut butter on my shoes. And they're like, what are you talking about? 10 years later, I was on Letterman. I put peanut butter on my shoes, the very first Letterman I ever did. And I remember all those guys from college calling me and going, oh, my God, you did it.
That's insane.
You put the peanut butter on your shoes. And it's just, it's been, that's been my whole life.
I've heard that story, but explain the peanut butter on the shoes.
Well, part of it was I just said it to those guys so I knew they'd always remember, because who says that, right? But I also knew if I ever did Letterman, I knew I wanted it to be silly.
But not Crispin Glover silly.
No, I wanted it to be my version of silly. And I thought, I think it would be funny in my head to put peanut butter all over my shoes and walk out on stage and do stand-up. And I did it. And that was the beginning of that.
So how long were you doing stand-up before you got on television?
I was doing stand-up, I think, about 7-8 years. But remember, that was all up in Canada.
Right. So,
actually, I shouldn't say that. It was about 5 years, because I got invited to Just for Laughs really quickly, too.
Right.
Like, that happened real quick for me. And so, by default, they put all their comics that make it to the gala showcase, they get on the TV show. So, I got on TV, but not kind of American
TV.
The
national, like, Letterman was your first time.
Letterman was my first big, like, talk show.
And how does, I mean, this was what, like, mid-'80s, late-'80s?
Yeah.
And now how does a comedian from Toronto get on Letterman at that time?
It was bizarre, dude. I mean,
because even still then, there was not a lot of comedians still.
Oh, I know.
I mean, it was booming. I mean, Tim Allen was around, Drew Carey.
Yeah.
You know, Roseanne was still popping pretty hard, Ellen.
Yeah.
You know, but I think it's so much harder then than it is now.
Well, it was crazy because, you know, a lot of times nowadays, guys get on because their agents make a call or they've got a connection.
Right.
But back when I did it, man, you had to do it the hard way. You had to get out in front of the booker.
Right.
You know, there was only Letterman and The Tonight Show. That was it.
Yeah.
And you had to get out in front of those guys and blow the roof off.
Right.
And so I had moved to Hollywood, and I had started making...
After Letterman?
No, this was
after
before.
JFL, after Just for Laughs?
This was after Just for Laughs,
gotcha.
Yeah. So I moved to Hollywood, and I started doing regular spots at the Hollywood clubs, the Laugh Factory, the Improv, all that, and I started getting noticed. Like, a lot of people noticed me.
So really, the old-fashioned way.
Yeah, and I ended up getting booked on Conan, and I got booked on all the... It's very bizarre. My first night on stage in Hollywood, I walked off stage and got offered 2 national TV shows. I got offered Comedy on the Road on A&E and Comic Strip Live on Fox. And
wow.
I just went, wow, this 6 years in Canada with nothing, you know, 6 minutes in Hollywood. And so it just went from there.
That's crazy.
And so people started really paying attention to me. And then Letterman's guys came to town. And they had a huge showcase at the Laugh Factory. Chris Rock, if you can believe it, had to audition. Damon Wayans, Larry Miller. These are just some of the names on the showcase I was on. I can't remember the other guys, but all of them were that level. I was the new kid in town, and I got put on right at the end. I was the last guy to go up. I think there was 12 or 15 of us.
Wow.
And I just sat at the back of the room watching these guys, like these...
Destroy.
These guys that shouldn't even be auditioning. They're celebrities. They're huge comedy names.
Right.
And to be honest, they didn't destroy as much as I thought, because I could see in their face that they were so aware that they were auditioning for the Letterman guy. I could sense that trepidation a little bit. You know, you can feel on a comedian if they're nervous or if they're confident.
Yeah.
And I could, most of them, even though they had great sets and they're brilliant comedians, I could taste a little bit of that.
Right.
You know, I'm on for the guy. And I went, man, I'm a nobody. Nobody from Letterman knows my name. I'm about to go on last after 15 AAA power slammers. I can see they're all a little bit edgy and nervous. I said, I'm just going to go up and walk through this like I'm having the time of my life.
Yeah, it's crazy.
I'm just going to go up and just, I'm going to throw it to the crowd. I'm going to throw it to the wind. I'm going to do my act and just have fucking fun. Pardon my French.
That's okay.
So I went up there like I didn't have a care in the world, dude. And
That wasn't Eddie Brill then, was it?
No. This was way before Eddie
Brill. By the way,
this
was
Dan, I forget his last name. It'll come to me. But anyways, I went up and blew the roof. It was one of the best sets I've ever had. And I walked off stage. They went, "You're on Letterman."
Yeah, you know, you're absolutely right. And just being in that, I'm in that world right now of just trying to do those things.
Yeah.
And I've found more success, auditions. You just don't care.
Yeah, you just
not. You know what I mean?
When you say don't care, it's not that you don't care. It's mean. What I learned is you do it for yourself.
Just
you go in and I go into my spirit and I go, "Harland, what brought you here?" It's that spirit that you know you were funny, or you believe you're funny at the very least. Just latch on to your spirit and let your spirit come out on that stage and let it wash over people. And it did. And it did at the right moment. And I just had such a powerful set. And to have such a strong set after all those amazing people, like I didn't think there'd be laughs left in the room. I thought it'd be like a sponge that was squeezed dry. But the laughs came out for me. And it was just uproarious. And it just sealed the deal. And I was like so grateful and excited. And
wow,
it was amazing. It was just amazing.
No, I was just, this is such a weird aside, but last night I was talking to Eddie Brill and he said hello.
Oh, that's nice.
Yeah.
Oh,
that's
good.
Why I asked. I know he was there for a while. So
yeah,
that was
he
probably...
ended up when I, when he wasn't there when I did my first, it was Zoe Friedman when I did my first one. And I'll never forget the look on her face when she saw me walk out of the elevator with peanut butter on my shoes. She just about fainted. But then I went on to do Letterman, I think 7 or 8 times, and then Eddie Brill came in around middle of that. So tell him I said hello back.
He just did this podcast.
Oh, that's nice.
Yeah, yeah.
Give him my love.
Good
man.
Dude.
Yeah.
Wow. So then you're doing stand-up. Did you start touring immediately, or?
No.
How
I didn't
work?
Want a tour. I refused a tour. I remember there were agents in Hollywood calling me up. They wanted me to join their agencies I forget.
As a road manager and get you on the road.
Yeah, as a in Hollywood they have actually like specific Irvin Arthur, for example, back then, great, wonderful guy. He handled all the top like Ellen DeGeneres and Jay Leno and all these. And these guys were begging me to join their agency, and I was just like, again, I was a bit naive. I think my naivety. Like, kind of got me through all this because I just had a kind of this, like, oh, no, thank you.
Right.
You know, just, no, I'm good. Like, I didn't even think it. And
but
I just.
But, like, you're in LA. Were you making money?
No, I was starting to do. I had my conviction. I said, I'm in LA. Why am I going to go on the road? In my head, I was like, how am I going to get a sitcom?
Oh, right. Everything's
happening
here.
And how am I going to do movies if I'm not here? So I just decided I'm not going to take gigs, and I'm not going to get, and so I was turning down these great people, these huge agents, and I didn't even realize it. And so I stayed in town, and the movies and the sitcoms and all that stuff started happening.
When did that start happening? Like, what was the first thing you ever got? Acting wise,
I did. Ellen had a show called, before it was Ellen, she had a sitcom called These Friends of Mine.
Yeah, I've heard of that.
And that they it was the same show as Ellen, but then they renamed it because Friends came out, and I think it was too close. It had the word Friends. So my first acting gig, I got a guest starring role.
Yeah.
On These Friends of Mine, and it was me and Molly Shannon were the two guest stars that week. So that was my very first. TV acting gig, and my next TV acting gig, I got my own sitcom with Jason Bateman called Simon, and I played Simon.
Yeah, I remember hearing about that.
I made a big leap from guest starring to my own sitcom.
You got to YouTube that. Tell people what Simon was about.
Simon was basically about I played kind of a Forrest Gumpy type of guy who worked at a vintage TV station like TV Land or whatever.
I watched that years ago on YouTube.
Yeah, and I was kind of just this guy, kind of like my life. I just kind of stumble into good things.
Yeah,
and Jason Bateman played my brother, who was kind of this guy that was always kind of pressing the pitting that pavement and trying to get a leg up and
Jason
trying
Bateman
to
character.
Trying to do all the things you do to get ahead in life, and he couldn't get anywhere.
Yeah.
And I was this goofy brother who just by goofy luck just kept climbing, stumbling upwards.
Wow.
And so he played my brother and I played Simon, and we did a full season of that, and it was a blast. It was really fun.
So what year was Simon?
Simon was, I think it was 90, it was in the early 90s, I believe.
Yeah.
92 or 93, maybe.
And then, what was your first movie role?
Dumb and Dumber.
That was it.
That was it.
That was 90, yeah. Probably filmed that in 93.
Yeah, yeah.
It came out in 94, I think.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. Yeah.
And then, well, the rest is, I mean, you know, we don't have to go through every single project.
Yeah, no, whatever you want. This is your,
that's crazy.
This is your podcast, not mine.
So when you were acting and stuff, when did you finally go on stand-up tour?
Oh, I was in Houston, which is where we are now.
I know, that's crazy.
By the way, but I had been given my own movie to star in by Disney called Rocket Man.
Yes.
And we shot it in Houston. And I was living here. They got me this beautiful house in the real rich neighborhood, and they got me a Land Rover and a cell phone. It was a real star treatment. Boy, it was nice. I loved it. And we were here for like 4 months shooting Rocket Man because it was a really big kind of big budget movie. I think the budget was about 35, 40 million on that movie. And so I was missing doing my stand-up.
Yeah,
and so I found out where the local comedy club in Houston was. It's called the Laugh Stop, and it wasn't that far from the house that they gave me. It was only about 4 miles away.
Right.
So I went over there and just asked the owner. I said, "Can I get up and do like a guest spot just to keep my chops?" And he's like, "Are you kidding?" Like, and I was like, "Oh, this guy knows me." And it was very weird. I kind of didn't realize that I was kind of starting to be somebody
in
that world. I was naive to it.
Well, because Rocket Man was 96, 95.
Yeah, but I'd already done Dumb and Dumber,
and
Down Periscope and a few other than I'd. And so anyways, he said, "Oh yeah, come on up." And then so I did that, and then I guess about half a year later, or maybe 3-4 months later, he had called my agents and said, "Yeah, we'd like to bring Harlan in for 3 days for $18,000." And I went, "Excuse me?"
You're still naive about
what did he? He said, "What now? $18,000?" And I was like, "You know, that sounds really nice for 3 days." And so it was
and
like
so you that, really didn't realize that time, like, I could make pretty decent money.
I didn't realize. And then once I did that club, the floodgates opened. Every club in the country was just like, they were lining up. I was turning down gigs all over the place. To this day, I still am. I don't want to be on the road every weekend, you know.
Right.
But so I pick my places to go every year. But that's what started it. And so, that was my first road gig in the U.S. And I just kind of did it on a fluke, you know.
Yeah. So, that's crazy.
Yeah, yeah. And the guy Mark Babbitt, who ran the Laugh Stop, super nice guy, and he was kind of the guy. He mentored me, and kind of I'll never forget. I didn't even know how it worked because
right.
in Canada, when we did stand up, there was no media, there was no radio. You would go and you'd wake up and go get some lunch and go to the club at night.
Right.
But in the States, it's a whole different business. You wake up and you do 5 radio stations and 2 TV stations, then you do 5 more the next day. So Babbitt brought me into the Laugh Stop, and he picked me up at the airport, and he goes, "Okay, so in the morning I'll pick you up at 6 a.m. We're going to do 5 radio stations." And I swear to God, I went, "Yeah, I don't know. I'll see how tired I am." And he was like, "What?" And I said, "Yeah, I'll probably sleep in, but thank you." And he's like, "Okay." Like, I think he wasn't sure but again, I was naive.
That's crazy.
And sure enough, when I went to bed that night, I unplugged my phones. I was like, "Yeah, I don't want to get up at 6 o'clock. And I remember someone knocking on my door, and I remember like rolling over and putting a pillow over my head. And when he came to pick me up that night, he goes, "What happened to you?" I said, "Oh, yeah, I was tired. I didn't want to get up at 6 o'clock. I have a show to do tonight." And he was so like confused. And I didn't hear about it all till I got back home. And my agent went, "Did you not go to any press?" And I go, "No, I was sleepy." And it was just, and I realized it, that he was like freaking out. He's like, how is this guy not? And it was just hilarious. I had no idea, dude. It was
yeah,
so funny.
I mean,
because you have to do the press to get people to the club. But the good news is we still got people out at the club. But it was, that's how naive I was about the whole business side of it. Like when, I said, I just wanted to get up and make people laugh. And so it was weird.
And now you're still doing it.
I'm still doing, but now I get up. I don't say I'm sleepy. I get up and do the radio. I realize that's part of your commitment
that's
to
so crazy.
You support the club, but I had no idea. I just,
oh my gosh.
I didn't realize, you know, it's not an option really, you know, but I had no idea. So I was like, yeah, I'm going to sleep in.
That's insane.
Did you run out of battery yet?
No, we're okay.
Oh, wow.
No, we're about done.
Your battery must like me.
No, this is, they do pretty well.
Oh, thank you.
Harlan's going to buy one of these Zoom H4s.
I hope
what
it
we're
runs
recording
out
on.
Just when I'm about to tell you the meaning of life. Can you make that the last question?
Yes.
When your battery goes to the red,
yes.
I hope it runs out because I do have the answer.
All right. We'll get to that.
Yeah.
Before we get out of here, tell people you have a hilarious podcast.
Oh, yes. Thank you.
That it's a little bananas.
Yeah, it's berserk.
Yeah, tell people about that, Harlan Highway.
It's called The Harlan Highway, and it's Mondays and Thursdays. You can get it at my website, harlanwilliams.com, or at iTunes. And it's basically, it's just a half hour of or 45 minutes of me making up characters, talking about stupid stories, relaying some of my experiences from, you know, getting charged by a 500-pound silverback gorilla on a volcano in Africa to canoeing down a river in northern Ontario to climbing the faces of the statues at Easter Island. I mean, I just talk about anything that's happened in my life. And so it's, you know, it's just funny. It's humorous. It's silly. I do a lot of goofy characters.
Yeah.
And it's very kind of theater of the mind-ish.
Sure,
So it's not quite like typical, you know, like kind of news or interviews.
It's not like this.
It's just weird. It's just weird.
Yeah, you know? That's fine.
It's just odd.
No, so. I think it's a fun thing because I think it really kind of gets people to know your humor and your goofiness.
Yeah,
and kind of like what people to expect.
Yeah, that's
you know?
It.
Because I'm not saying this because you take me on the road or you're my friend, but like. You're one of the few people that you never know what you're going to get on stage. and I always tell you, I always tell Harlan when you get off stage, I'm like, I like this one thing you said.
Right, yeah,
that
right.
I've never heard you say.
That's right.
And it's some phrase or you called somebody something.
Right.
And that's always fun. And I think people love to see something different all the time.
Well, you know? I think this week you told me I was on stage and I don't know why I did it, but I walked out to the crowd. And I said, oh, it's great to be here in Houston. What a great crowd. Very sexual. Great.
Such
great.
Sexual energy here in Houston.
Just one, and I kept saying it. And
you
then when
said
I got
it like
off,
every 4 minutes.
Yeah, and when I got off stage, that was the thing you kind of picked off on.
Oh, there's been things, I mean, where you're like, you'll call, I think you called some dude, you kept calling him, you called him like, it was like the peanut brittle bandit or something like that.
I like that. Something I'll do it tonight.
Oh, you little peanut brittle bandit.
That sounds about right.
That doesn't even make any sense.
Sounds about right. Not much of it does. I think the world makes too much sense, and so I try to counterbalance that by making no sense.
I love that. I do love it.
Yeah. There you go.
Yeah. And everyone can follow you on Twitter, at Harlan Williams.
Twitter, at Harlan Williams.
Your tweets are about as goofy as Peanut Brittle Bandit.
Yeah, I did one this morning. I said I woke up this morning and went to Starbucks and really needed to wake up, so I poured a scalding hot coffee in my eyes. Thank you, caffeine.
Mm.
So I just tweet weird things.
Yeah,
and
it's fun.
You can also check out my webpage, harlanwilliams.com.
Yeah,
and all my stand-up comedy schedule is on there. You can find out what city I'm going to be in. I'm coming to Pittsburgh soon, which is your hometown.
Yes, it is.
And
I may not be there.
You won't be there, but
I
will. I'm going to stay with your family.
Aww.
The podcast, The Harlan Highway, man.
Well, check out Harlan. Dude, I appreciate it.
Oh, you're welcome.
And,
it's a pleasure.
But before we get out of here.
Yes.
You need to tell us the meaning of life.
Okay, you ready?
Yes.
Whenever you go down to the farm.
If you're a custodial supervisor at a local high school, you know that cleanliness is key and that the best place to get cleaning supplies is from Grainger. Grainger helps you stay fully stocked on the products you trust, from paper towels and disinfectants to floor scrubbers. Plus, you can rely on Grainger for easy reordering, so you never run out of what you need. Call 1-800-GRAINGER, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.